Well, hello, superstars, and welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Danny Katz. Today I am joined once again by author Joe Atwell, who came back on the show to help catch me and you and all of us up to speed on the history of anti-Semitism, on Masonic Zionism, and on the control that the Masons are still wielding over our culture through things as seemingly benign as religion, spirituality, literature, psychedelics, etc., etc. Before we dive into today's conversation, I am reminding you to click that subscribe button, to like, to share, to comment, to tell all your friends to tune in to Word Up with Danny Katz. I'm also reminding you to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com. It's the best way to ensure that we stay in touch, that you can stay apprised of my every next course, webinar, book drop, live event, etc. I think that does it for housekeeping. Buckle up and prepare to enjoy my conversation with Joseph Atwell. Joe Atwell, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Good to see you, Danny. Thanks for having me back.
Yes, it's a pleasure having you back. I've been doing a deep dive into your work, and I'm super excited to talk about Judaism, anti-Semitism, Zionism. But I want to start off with like one of your more kind of polarizing theories that Jesus didn't exist. So I was raised with no religion, and I think there are a lot of people like me as well. So a lot of your work is lost on me because, you know, references to the Gospels or Paul or this or that, I'm like, I don't even know who these people are. And I know you're a super smart guy. So if we're going with the theory that Jesus never existed, then what do we do with the whole like Merovingian Knights Templar, Mary Magdalene, like that whole kind of side narrative, how does that fold in to your perspective?
Well, the individuals who produced the Gospels had complete political control, and they also had control of the media of the era, the Roman road system. And so Christianity and the myth of Christianity spread. And so then shortly after, within a few hundred years, you started of the creation of the Gospels. You had Rome making or beginning the process by which Christianity would become the state religion, and the story of Jesus and legends concerning him, and I think groups that would spontaneously spring up around the mythology. I mean, basically, I don't have any sort of negation or issue with the history of Christianity from 400 CE forward. I think it's probably as we have received it. I think that's probably all correct. I just think at its origin, it was a politically constructed mythology. And then from there, it just took on a life of its own. I think there were charlatans and shills, but there were also people who were inspired. I mean, I would say the same phenomena exists today. You have within the category of Christian, you know, evangelists, you have people that are complete charlatans, and then you have mystics that have who think they talk to Jesus, and it's a very authentic experience for them. So this is my you know, take on it. I don't frankly think a lot, it has a lot of importance to my work, and it's not something that I'm that interested in. I mean, I know that this is going to disappoint people because it means so much to so many people, but the kind of mythology and spiritualism that comes out of Christianity is not, you know, really doesn't have much to do with Caesar's Messiah. And with my book, I had, you know, so much to take on in terms of antagonism from scholarship and from Christians, that I really didn't want to go any further than just stay within like the first century and with the origins of the literature in terms of my analysis and in terms of what I was criticizing. So I'm sorry. I don't mean to be evasive, but that's just, my position on all that.
No, not at all. It's like I'm putting the pieces together kind of from the a weird angle that I was never interested in it at all. But I happen to be, I'm currently reading Jesus in the Essenes by Dolores Cannon. And it, like, that version sounds like a lovely guy, but I don't have any attachment to this Messiah story. If it did start out as propaganda or a psyop, is that related to this like kind of newfangled Christian push that we're seeing coming out of the right, the truther movement, like whatever that is happening right now?
No, I don't think so. I think that there's a lot of people that are simply deluded. Our world is filled with them, and they create a lot of kind of craziness that sort of occupies our world and our vision of it, our understanding of it. And it's a shame because at the origin of all that, there is just mythology. In terms of sort of political Christianity, to a large degree, is controlled by Zionism, or what I would call Masonic Zionism. That's really been the thing that shaped it. It's the strongest political and financial power within it. They're strongly supportive of Israel and of Zionism, and that understanding certainly doesn't come from the Christian text, which are pretty anti-Semitic. And very anti-Israel. I mean, in the Gospels, the Jews are condemned to have the blood libel. The blood of the murdering of the Messiah would be on them forever. So there was a complete rationale inside the Gospel for the diaspora. So you have to wonder, well, how can it be that modern Christians, Zionist Christians, have such a contradictory position to the text? And I would just say that they've been manipulated by what I refer to as Masonic Zionism, that has tremendous influence in the media and is able to put people into positions of authority within Christianity that are basically shills for them, to create this support for Israel and for Zionism that doesn't come from the Christian text. It just comes from modern political power.
So I want to dive into Masonic Zionism, but before that, I'm going to invite you to walk me through this slowly, because I've heard my whole life, the Jews killed Jesus. How many Jews killed Jesus that an entire race shoulders the blame for thousands of years? Like, is there something that I'm missing there? I thought humans killed Jesus. Assuming the story's even real.
It's a completely bizarre and irrational assertion. I mean, it's bearing in mind that Jesus, as he presents himself as the son of David and the Messiah, would be, under any circumstance, someone who would have a tremendous amount of support from the Jewish people in this era. And so the charge that the Gospels make was propaganda, and it was done to promote anti-Semitism. That was something that was important to the Roman imperial class. And to understand that, you really have to kind of know a little bit about the history of the era. Rome is a prison of nations and of ethnicities in the first century. The Pax Romana concept was never really, universally correct. There was always little rebellions going on. People hated being colonized. And certainly the Jews, or many of the Jews in Judea, felt that way. And so there was over 150 years, there was a series of rebellions. And the rebellions were messianic. They were, would be sort of natural within the Jewish religion that they would look to a leader that would have the same kind of connection to God that David did, right? The original Messiah, because this would give them a military advantage. There's nothing better than having God on your side when you're waging war. So The rebellions against Rome were messianic, and they were absolutely bloodbath and existential to the Roman Empire. It's kind of been forgotten to history. I think it's been sort of deliberately written out, but these were the most threatening rebellions to the Roman Empire that it ever faced. There were three major ones. One, the famous one between 66 and 73, where the temple was razed, and this was the one that Jesus's prophecies are regarding. But you also have, 115. You have the Kiddos Rebellion, absolute bloodbath. The Jews gained control of the island of Cyprus and genocided 250,000 Gentiles on the island. The areas of Cyrenia, modern-day Libya, they were depopulated to the extent that Rome had to recolonize them. They'd just been completely depopulated by the Jewish rebellion. There's a letter of the Roman magistrate of Alexandria trying to escape going south down the Nile. He was trying to escape. So you can see how powerful the rebellions were. And then finally, the one in 133 with Bar Kokhba, which was, again, just on the razor's edge. Rome won, and this led to the diaspora. But these rebellions were sort of the political context in which, the Gospels come from. Mm-hmm. And so anti-Semitism was something that the Roman patrician class wanted to promote, because the thing they really wanted to stop was any kind of missionary activity. Josephus mentioned this, that the Jews of the era were engaged in missionary activity, both with Gentiles and with people who had Jewish backgrounds who were dispersed throughout the empire. So Christianity was just, there was many reasons for it. But one of the main things was just to prevent any missionary activity by in replacing the militaristic Messiah with one that was, pro-Roman and turned the other cheek. So it was just basically social control. And in that context of social control, they threw in, the anti-Semitic flavor that you find in the Gospels.
And was this turn the other cheek strategy similar to the version that we see coming through the modern day psychedelic and New Age movements?
Yeah, actually, good analogy. It, I am very critical of the New Age psychedelic movement, and I think it's basically at its core, it has propaganda and mind control. It's not sort of an organic movement that's attempting to liberate people and elevate our spiritual levels. I mean, drugs were inserted for the purpose of delusion. This was why, at the original kind of origins of the drugs. I mean, for example, magic mushrooms with Gregory Bateson and Maria Sabina. I mean, this was a CIA project. It was part of MK Ultra. It has pay receipts, and the program has a name. I think it was Subproject 56 or 66. And then ayahuasca. I mean, this was an exact mirror of the Wasson's trip to discover the magic mushroom. Burroughs, the Naked Lunch author, Freemason, he met with a CIA head. Then he traveled with a CIA handler and protector, a former OSS martial arts guy, went to Mexico City where Burroughs murdered his wife, got off somehow after shooting her in the head, and then traveled into the Amazon jungle where he claimed to discover the very last shaman in existence who turned him on to ayahuasca. So, it's not a believable story. And particularly when you hold it up to Wasson's story, you can see the parallels are just vivid. So why did they do this? Well, they, for the same reason that they ran the MK Ultra experiments, they were trying to figure out drugs that could be used for the purpose of social control. And they had in mind that the psychedelic drugs were basically very, made people very suggestible. Mm-hmm. And then I would say, if you want to see sort of the conclusion of that project, look at Woodstock, you know, where they have, you know, turning everyone on to LSD. And the social control that was going on was simply they were trying to break down the family. The family is a very powerful political unit. Oligarchs don't like it. Families lead to community, lead to ethnic strength. What they want is individuals. You know, they want isolated people. So this was, you know, why sex, drugs, and rock and roll were given, particularly to, you know, my generation in the late 60s, early 70s. It was with the idea of putting marriage and family production in a bad light socially, and, you know, making yourself think that you were hip if you were doing your own thing and having a lot of hookup sex and taking drugs, which, you know, I can unfortunately say from experience, doesn't really lead you to any kind of, you know, kind of, valuable life, but it's a way to waste a lot of time. And this was, you know, what happened. And, you know, it's interesting. I know you had an interview with my very good friend, Robert Forte, who is like one of my best friends. And Robert, you know, he knows tremendous amount about sort of the government influence in the movement. And he and a lot of people that I know are kind of in the same situation where they say, well, there is so much good that can come out of it. Out of drugs, you know, there is therapy and spiritual elevation and things. And I have to say that no, at this point, we need to stop it altogether, because there is no way we can be sure until we've got a complete vetting of what the malevolent had in mind for the drugs. In other words, we don't really know the truth about long-term side effects. We don't really know how it affects consciousness over long terms. And we need to do really, I mean, I would suggest that we need to do really critical and objective studies of all of the drugs before we then, you know, think that there was some kind of ambivalence back in the 60s or 70s, or there was some good and some bad. I mean, I know there was, obviously, and I would say Robert is one of the most, like, clear-minded and spiritually elevated persons I know. But nevertheless, I would just say that at this point that we've, since we've discovered, you know, MK Ultra and the malevolence in back of the counterculture, we really need to stop and just do a complete review, a citizen's review of psychedelic drugs, so that, you know, we can actually start to see if they're actually useful at all to us.
I mean, I have a theory. In hearing what you're saying as far as psychedelic movements, I completely agree, because I think all movements are psyops. I have not seen an example of a movement that doesn't involve some sort of like groupthink or cult like narrowing of opinion.
Danny, I just mean, you know, I hate to say it, but I totally agree with you. And I mean, I know it's just such a difficult position, and you're courageous to bring this up. But I believe that, I mean, after my research, this is what the same position I came to.
I appreciate the validation, because I've, you know, like someone asked me, I was on a podcast recently, you know, what do you think about the health freedom movement? And I'm like, I don't really want anything to do with it. Regarding psychedelics, I mean, they're gifts from source, right? Not necessarily LSD or MDMA, but mushrooms grow under cow patties. You know, iboga, sure, is iboga. I feel like take them away from the movements, get away from this idea of experts or authority figures who need to be some sort of go-between ourselves and our own consciousness, and let the people who are courageous enough do whatever they want, because I feel like that's where In my experience, like lone wolf explorers don't seem to be the problem as those who want to, start a church, create a movement, bring the government into them. As far as finding a baseline, it's like, where is a baseline these days given, chemtrails, fluoride in the water, GMOs? It's like, what is even the human physiological, psycho-emotional baseline in 2021, if we were to remove all the fuckery, all the toxicity, would the laws of nature even work the same?
I have an acquaintance who is an expert in native shamanistic drug use, and I won't mention his name. I'm not sure he'd want me to, but close friend. In fact, I gave him a blurb for his book, and that seems to me to be completely real. The spirituality it promotes, peyote and with other, native plants. This would be something that the lone wolves produced for themselves. It wasn't done with the under the auspice of social control. And so, I mean, I don't want to, be a buzzkill for everyone, who wants to take peyote or something. I mean, I don't have a position on any of that, but I am saying that in terms of social movement, in terms of us, like the latest thing with microdosing or, the controversy about MDMA. No, I'm afraid that those kinds of chemicals, that are associated with government control and propaganda, and we need to just say no to them. And if you're interested in them, you really want to do more careful vetting of the chemical and what it can do. And so, I mean, that's all I can say is that it's just we haven't really drained out of the out of the drug use in our culture, the malevolence. And until you do that, you don't really know what you're getting. I would take the same position with therapy, psychological therapy. I mean, I completely understand that Freud and Jung and their cult were evil and malevolent, and I think that the pseudo therapy that they were developing is bad for us. And in terms of modern therapy, until that fact is kind of presented to the to this concept, and we go through the whole thing and see, well, what is bad, what is left over, what could be malevolent. Once you discover malevolence at the origin, you have a real trouble trying to weed it out from all of the things that have grown out of it that could possibly be good. But you just have to go through the process. At least this would be my position, is that you really need to have a very strong vetting process of critical, citizens looking at all of this stuff and trying to make sure that there isn't thing buried in it that will damage us, because they were designed to damage us at the origins, and what they grew into is without really proper vetting, you can't be certain of being safe.
Agreed, agreed. We're very much on the same page with this. I want to go back to the Romans creating anti-Semitism. Was it as simple as creating a scapegoat? Was it a simple divide and conquer? Was there a reason why Jews were pinpointed? Because that story has seems to have lasted quite a long time.
The Jews were pinpointed because their rebellions were the most successful, and so this was the cause of it. And then I think there is, kind of a negative serendipity. In the beginning of the 4th century, Constantine then chose Christianity as to make it the state religion of Rome. Now, he could have chosen the imperial cult or dozens of other things. I think he chose it because it was monotheistic, and moreover, because it was his family that had created it back in the 1st century. Now, this was really bad luck for the Jews, because even though there were very few Jews within the Roman Empire at this point, the literature had the anti-Semitism that was reflective of the first century within it. And so then the concept of Jews being the Christ killer and the blood would be of his blood would be on their hands was just disseminated widely. And as Jews, started to populate Europe more and more, the claims found in the Gospels, became activated, and this was certainly part of it. But there of course there's the other side of all this. The Jews were suffering from their scripture. They have a Deuteronomy wherein you have the most racist positions that humans have ever created, where you're talking about God, giving the permission to the Jews to kill whole ethnicities down to the last child. So you can see that the problem is the scripture. The scriptures of the Abrahamic tradition scriptures have been an absolute catastrophe, and they have kind of established the mindset of the subjects of the literature in a very malevolent form, where Jews are looking at Deuteronomy and they're looking at the first century, and so they're developing strategies of genocide against the Gentiles, and the Gentiles are doing the same thing to them. Their scriptures are influencing them, and then of course you have Islam, which then comes in and gives permission to basically kill the Jews and the Gentiles. So the scripture, I mean, if you just stand back, and look at it, you look at the Old Testament. You have the Jews are always in a disadvantaged military situation. These are this is, so essentially it's war literature. David is fighting Goliath. God helps him out. God holds back the sun so they can defeat, the people of Jericho. So you have this oligarchic sort of propaganda that would create more zealotry in the soldiers, right, of the ethnicity of the religion. In terms of the Christian scripture, you read Caesar Messiah and you'll see my position on that. And the Quran is the same thing. It just has constant descriptions of these kind of war structures that Muhammad is having to deal with, and God is helping him out. So this was the, these this literature was created in an era, pre-Enlightenment, where ethnic struggle was basically religious struggle, and religion and ethnicities were where they were structured to fight and to promote one another's battle victories. So anyway, this was damaging the Jewish mind as well as the Gentile mind as well. And then, at a certain point, we have the Enlightenment, where the literature that comes from this primitive condition was scrutinized, and there it was understood, certainly by the intellectuals of the era, that we really could get beyond this literature. This literature was holding us up. And you started to have, an erosion of the political power of Christianity in Europe. But the most important part of all this was that in the Jewish intellectuals, they were actually the ones who were the avant-garde of the kind of a way of transcending the original literature. And I don't know, because it's been buried, unfortunately, but how many people are even aware of the intellectuals that made up what was called at that time Reform Judaism in the 19th century? One of my favorite scholars is Abraham Geiger. And Geiger, he took the position that religion was evolving. You see, the concept of evolution now was even in play a bit. And he said, really what we need to do was to look at the diaspora not as a punishment or a challenge of the Jews, but as an opportunity. He said, you know, we can use this as a way of taking ethical monotheism, that was his term. And he actually says we can be a light to all of the nations. In other words, he actually took the position that you could take Judaism, transcend Deuteronomy, and change your relationship to the text, see the text as just a stage within the evolutionary process, and then come to a position where you could take the religion and turn it into something that would be a light for everyone, that all of mankind would benefit from this ethical monotheism. And believe it or not, I mean, Geiger was not some kind of eccentric Jewish intellectual. This became the actual Jewish majority in the 19th century, which is just hard to believe now. But they actually had, and I was going to say that, so Geiger, he actually created a prayer book that he took out all references to Zion. He took out all references of genocidal slaughter. He was trying to change the text of the Old Testament to be something that would be strictly promoting ethical monotheism for the entire world. And I would just say that people who are interested in what mankind can become, read Geiger's works. He was really an amazing and inspirational character. And so when the Freemasons then decided to basically create Israel and to restore or to make Masonic Zionism powerful, they had to fight against the Jews. They had to fight against people like Hirsch and Einhorn and Holdheim, people that have been forgotten. But these guys actually formed a resistance against them and had like the Frankfurt Conference, and they had like the Central Conference of American Rabbis in like 1870 or something, 1880. And they publicly opposed the Zionist ideology that was starting to be promoted so powerfully. So this was real Judaism. This was the Judaism that had emerged organically following the Reformation and the Enlightenment. And if that Judaism had have succeeded, then the world would be a completely different place today. I mean, it was their destruction, their defeat was the worst thing that has ever happened, even though it gets almost no publicity. Mm-hmm. And they were defeated by the Masonic Zionists. And so what occurs is, in like in 1840, Lord Palmerston, who is the Prime Minister of England, he made a public declaration, and he said, now is the time for the Jews to return to the Holy Land. He makes this public
statement. Palmerston a Jew?
No. See, this is the thing you have to remember, is that in the destruction of the Jewish religion, the Reformed Jews, none of the people involved in its destruction at the onset are Jews. You have, you know, they're all Freemasons.
Right.
They are British royalty. The British royal family was involved. They were high-level British politicians. But really what was the unifying aspect is that they're all high-level Freemasons. Every one of them is. So they took this position that the Jews, it was now time for the Jews to return to the Holy Land. And believe me, as one wag commented, this was news to the Jews. And they were very, you know, I mean, these people, Palmerston and the Churchill family, the Cecils, the Balfours, I mean, all of these individuals are ostensibly, you know, they're like Anglicans, Church of England, Presbyterian. I think that they see themselves as some kind of lost tribe. Mm-hmm. They would have a mythology about themselves as being, you know, this lost tribe concept. They actually would use that, but they are not Jews. They are all purportedly Christians. The closest thing to a Jew they have in them is Disraeli, who comes from a Jewish family, but converted to Christianity. So he would be the the lone person that would have any connection into Judaism, even though he had converted to Christianity. And this group then creates Herzl, who then is the father of Jewish Zionism. But he is simply an employee of this group. I mean, Herzl is funded, and in fact, the original speeches he's giving are actually just translations of speeches that the original proto, what I call the proto-Zionists, were making before him. And so then Herzl organizes, the modern Masonic Zionism, and you get, Ben-Gurion and Golda Meir, and these groups are all coming from conferences that they were organizing and funding. And the Masonic Zionists were actually paying for people to go and proselytize to the different congregations about the kind of the righteousness of their version of Zionism. And so, going forward, you can see that the Freemason hand is over the whole thing. It's particularly clear, like in the actual in sort of the Balfour Declaration, which comes from this group. The Balfour Declaration is from the Cecil family, really. He's one of the premier Masonic Zionists. And they make an agreement with the Palestinians and with the Arabs, with the Arabs in general, through Hussein. And Hussein was sort of the head Arab Islamic ruler at the time, had a lot of power. And he worked with a guy named McMahon, who was a general. He was the British plenipotentiary. And they cut the deal whereby the Arabs would fight against the Ottomans, the Turks. And at the end of the war, for their sacrifice, Britain promised that they would have Arabia. It would be their region, and Arabs would be able to establish would have political power over it. Mm-hmm. Well, right in the middle of this, you have the Balfour Declaration, which completely contradicts the original agreement with Hussein, and you get to fortunately, McMahon wrote a letter to one of his colleagues, and he just flatly says, "This is a complete lie. I'm just telling Hussein that we're going to give him this area. We're not. I don't mean it. They won't have any power. We'll just take what we want at the end of World War I. So you have to remember that McMahon, even though he was a general, he's the head Freemason of the region. You see, is the head Freemason. So here you have sort of the Masonic Zionism. Its power is finally completely manifested, because with the Balfour Declaration and with the lying to the Arabs, they can actually establish Israel. The Arabs paid the blood price. I mean, they were fooled. They went against the Turks. They lost over, it was like 100,000 men were killed, 500,000 casualties, a real bloodbath. And at the end of the war, they expected to be given this region. But of course, we know what happened. So anyway, when you can see the one thing I would just wanted to point out is that Masonic Zionism requires constant lying. I mean, mm-hmm. every single claim it makes, right, is lying. They cannot tell the truth about anything, because the actual project they're involved with is so nefarious that if they were honest, right, the public would rebel against it. So they have to lie. So my point is that when you get to someone like Netanyahu, mm-hmm. and you say, this individual seems to be crazy. I mean, he can't put two words next to each other without lying. Mm-hmm. Well, this is why. Because you see, the law has become so complicated, has so many aspects to it, that there's nothing they can do now other than lie. And I would say, if you look at the October the 7th incursion, by Hamas, and you start picking into it, and you go, all of these problems with the story, that suddenly don't add up, they don't make any sense. When you look at the context, Danny, of the whole process, you can see that, of course, the claim that you know there were the beheaded babies and Hamas was invading, you know, for you know because they're subhuman or whatever. I mean, of course, they're lying about this. They just want a pretext to continue with the Greater Israel project, you're going to see. There will be more violence. I mean, the current situation we have, you know, with Iran and, you know, Lebanon and whatnot, this is just a stepping stone. They're going to attempt to establish Eretz Israel, and they're going to need to take a lot of Egypt, all of Syria, all of Lebanon, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. If they're going to actually establish the territory that Judas Maccabee had envisioned back in you know like 2nd century BCE, they're going to have to these wars are just going to go on and on and on. And I was really amazed last week when the finance minister of Israel, Solo Mitten, his last name, he actually came out and said it. He said, you know, we're just going to have to take all of these countries eventually. Every one of them is going to have to be depopulated and then colonized by Israel because he said, it is written. It is written. So the wars are just going to go on. The lying is just going to go on. And, this is our world. We have this problem we should be trying to deal with.
Is it just about land and territory? Like, why did the Masonic Zionists set their sights on Israel? Like, what is really going on there? It seems...
I'm betting, I mean, I don't know, because remember, this is a secret society, and at the top, they keep all of this, you know, very tightly inside their organization. But what I think is happening is that they... have an oath-taking system, and as you go up the Masonic ladder, you take more and more severe oaths. And one of the things you promise is to restore Israel. And what I am betting, and
what
I
does
have
that mean? What does restore Israel mean?
What it would mean is, they have a very severe version of restoration. What they're talking about is the boundaries of Judas Maccabee. He's the one who said that, you know, we need to establish, you know, all of the Nile. What he did was, what Maccabee did was, is he took all of the stories about sort of the Jewish war and culture, and all of everything that, every geographical location that had some kind of connection, he just said, that's really what God wants to give us. Maccabee was he was a fundamentalist. He was opposed to the gymnasium culture that the Seleucids were imposing upon the Jews in Judea. I mean, after Alexander the Great's death, you know, they carved up his empire. His general Seleucid, he got the area around Judea, and he brought in Greek culture. And Greek culture, you know, has sensuality. The gymnasium is a big thing. Steam baths, you know, and it's polytheistic, and you know, art and beauty are huge components. Well, this just struck the Maccabees in the wrong way, and they wanted to kick out the Seleucids and return to a really more Orthodox Judaism. Maccabee was successful. He drove them out, and then he compulsorily circumcised any Gentile that wanted to remain in the area.
So, was Maccabee a Mason? Like, what's...
No, I don't think so. I think he was just a legitimate fundamentalist. I mean, you know, if you want to get a sense of like how fundamental some of the Jews were during this era, read the Dead Sea Scrolls. You know, where you just have, you know, really strict protocol of behavior, all kinds of punishments for even little tiny infractions. I mean, they were just very fundamental, And they just couldn't abide with the Greek culture that was being, and so many Jews were being swept up into it. And so they wanted to return to, this like a more fundamental religion. And they were able to do it for a period of time. But then Rome, onset, and we're off to the problems of the Roman rebellions. But the Jews that were rebelling against Rome were fundamental. What happens is you get dialectic, where the Greek and Roman culture is seen as overly sensual, and so the religious reaction to it is, has a response of being overly ascetic. And so this was kind of how the what was set up inside of Judea for like a couple hundred years, and it led to these just absolute bloodbaths. And so then when the Masons pick up the these mythologies and historical facts, I think they set up in their oath structure that they wanted to fix that. The Masons are completely aware of like the analysis I did in Caesar's Messiah. I've actually had communications with Masons who've pointed this out to me, that they know that Christianity was fake. But oddly enough, it's like the people who set up the Masonic Zionism, I would bet like 10 to 1 that they are not religious at all. Religion to these people is really just a tool for social control. And they want to control, the Jews just as much as they want to control Gentiles. As an example, it would be probably too long a digression, but anti-Semitism was, was flared up with the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, right? I mean, this flares up anti-Semitism, and it kind of prepares the way for Hitler, because it created this sort of concept that the Jews were trying to control the world.
But wasn't
And
that, but it was blamed on the Jews, but it didn't really originate from the Jews. Is that
well,
correct?
here, let me tell you that actually very few people know how where it comes from. The protocols were actually discovered and brought to us by, oh, forget her name, but she was the secretary of Helen Blavatsky, Julinka. Her name was Julia Julinka. She was and she was a member of the Theosophical Society, from which you end up getting, if you read my paper on the Freemason invention of the Nazi Party, you can see that all of that comes, or they use the Theosophical Society as basically the main kind of propellant for the cultural aspects that would end up inside of National Socialism. I mean, the swastika, and in particular, a concept of like Aryan. The German people never used the term Aryan. They didn't know what that was. This was coming from the Theosophical Society, and they brought all of this kind of German race paganism. It was all through Helen Blavatsky. Well, anyway, they were trying to figure out how they could stir up some anti-Semitism, and so they conjured up the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And Jelinka, who was the secretary to Blavatsky, she says, "Hey, I discovered this," and then they distributed it in during World War I in Russia. It was part of kind of how they were forming this energy of anti-Semitism. But then, following the war, they needed to debunk the protocols, because these guys are very philo-Semitic. I mean, they don't want to keep anti-Semitism animated. They wanted it because they wanted to form the Nazi Party. I mean, my take is that they wanted to move the people of Europe around like chess pieces on a board. And so they wanted basically to punish the Germans, because this was where the Roman Empire had ended up, for the first century. But they also wanted to move Jews into Judea to reestablish Israel. So they just had this long-standing idea of how they were going to rearrange, kind of how the world was structured. So they need anti-Semitism was very useful for them, but they had to get rid of it. And so they discovered a book from which the quotes had been taken. And the person who found this book, or the person who brought the person who had the book with him to the public was this young guy named Alan Dulles, who then went on to be the head of the CIA. So the story is just ridiculous, right? It's just, you know, ridiculous. It's just a psyop. But that's the protocols, is they were useful at a purpose, at a purpose at a time, and then they weren't. And, you know, you go in, I mean, I am of the position that we know more about the future than we do about our past. Mm-hmm. At this point, I don't believe anything. I do not believe a single one of the stories that are have been given to us. I don't trust any of them. Mm-hmm. I don't trust the Holocaust. I don't trust World War I. I don't trust Christianity. I don't trust Shakespeare. I mean, read my book on Shakespeare. You want to see cynicism. But anyway, Hitler, you know, he comes out of, you know, he's supposedly, you know, this the energy that was existing in Germany, you know, they wanted to reestablish their race, which was, you know, not really historically correct. The German people weren't really interested in Aryanism. These were ideas that were coming from the Theosophical Society. And they were the groups like the Tool Society that actually then produces the Nazi Party. But the amazing thing is that Hitler is seen as this, you know, highly animated, you know, kind of insane individual. But if you actually look at the letters of the people who knew him, and that he, in fact, was an individual, had no agency at all. Mm-hmm. The really amazing thing about Hitler to me is that he was put in place by Sabatendorf, who had been basically the military dictator of Germany in World War I. He was still wielding a tremendous amount of power. And Sabatendorf wanted to kind of unify with the Theosophical Society and the Tool Society, these ideas of the Aryan race, you know, and the German genetic, you know, people. And he spent a couple years looking for a girl. He had in mind that he was going to find a red-haired kind of Swiss Miss type in the mountains, and she was going to be his parallel to Joan of Arc. This is what he was looking for. So he wasn't looking for a person with agency who could like make their own decision, right? He was looking for a teenage girl with red hair, and he couldn't find her. Couldn't find anyone that would like really, you know. So the guy he was working with said, well, you know, I know a guy, he's like, he called him a beaten dog, but you know, I think we can use him because he likes to talk. It was Hitler. This is how they picked him.
That does it for the first half of my conversation with Joe Atwell. As you are inspired to scope out the second half of our conversation, you can find that over on both my Locals and Patreon communities. Those addresses are dannycatz.locals.com and patreon.com/dannycatz. At both of my membership communities, for as little as $5 a month, you get access to all of my second half conversations, oodles of bonus content, plus the uber gratifying knowledge that you are supporting me in keeping on, keeping on. Also reminding you, since Joseph and I do talk about the ills of propaganda in our culture, I am reminding you that I have the world's only pop propaganda media literacy course for teens, which is also appropriate for grownups. I created this course for the teens that I was homeschooling, and I digitized it in response to the copious amounts of demand I was getting to teach this class live. It is available now, right now, for immediate lifetime access. When you register through my website, dannycatz.com, you get access to all 11 modules, which include video lessons, which include PDFs, which include original animations, illustrations. I really went the distance to make this course chock full as well as fun and entertaining. When you complete the course, you will absolutely, positively, guaranteed be able to recognize propaganda as soon as it's being disseminated. When we do that, those tricks and techniques no longer work on us, which allows us to safeguard our critical thinking, to safeguard our agency, our confidence, our self-esteem, and move through the world unfazed by propaganda, media manipulation, and groupthink. So run, don't walk, to register for Pop Propaganda now. And thank you so much for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. I will see you over on the Patreon and the locals. Have a rockin' day.